So I came all the way over here. You said you was holding.
I didn't say what I was holding.
Anton Tobias never had much on his mind.
Don't you think you should have like a goal?
My dream life would be to lie around all day in bed and watch TV while some hot broad delivers me food.
And he always had time on his hands.
Four bodies have been discovered, and the killer is still at large.
Until one of them got a mind of its own.
I have no control over my hands. It makes me do things that I don't want it to do.
Aren't you a little old for ding-dong ditch?
Sorry about your bush. I'm gonna call 911.
What's the number?
I'm not the killer, okay?
I mean, if OJ could get off, then I'm sure.
You there?
Now, his hand won't stop.
I don't want to hurt you.
Don't!
Ew, that's disgusting.
His friends won't die.
Dead!
Undead, actually. There was this big, bright white light at the end of a long tunnel.
That's what happened.
We were like, forget that, man. Too far.
And the only way to stop it...
Idle hands are the devil's playpen, so keep my hands occupied, right?
...is to keep it busy.
Freeze!
Drop the knitting needles. That's probably not a good idea.
Put him down!
Cuff me!
Presents.
The police have no leads, and the killer is still out there.
You scream like a girl.
The comedy.
Careful, it's on kind of loose.
It's really starting to get on my nerves.
That dares to give scary movies.
Hey, look at me! I'm in the face!
The backhand.
What are you doing, man? That's my dad. Come on.
CPR, man. I saw him Baywatch.
Did you lose something there, bud?
Idle hands. Touching story of a boy and his hand.
Kinky.
Fly for a white guy.
And welcome to the Cult Cinema Circle podcast. My name is Jesse, and I'll be your host. Now, on today's episode, we are going to try to, you know, not have our hand kill everybody, you know, because that's just something we have to worry about nowadays, I guess. But you know what? We had to worry about it back like 25 years ago, too, because today we're going to be covering a little movie from 1999, a little horror comedy, if you will, called Idle Hands. But for this film, I could not just do this on my own. No, sir. I had to bring someone in who I would honestly say is quite the expert when it comes to cult movies and just horror movies and, you know, all the stuff in general. He's a filmmaker, a screenwriter, a producer, and a host with a variety of different things going on in his life. He has written a movie for Netflix called Christmas With You and also Christmas in Vermont, and also a Lifetime movie that is called The Wrong Stepmother. We'll talk about it. And has also been the creator and host of the podcast Dead for Filth, which is a podcast devoted to the intersection of queer identity and the horror genre. And currently, most recently now, he is the co-host and guest co-creator of the Midnight Mass podcast with Peaches Christ. But please welcome to my show the one, the only, Michael Verratti. Hi, Michael. How are you doing?
Hello. I'm great. Thank you for that lovely introduction. And in fact, I'm really thrilled, probably of interest to your listeners. I'm one of the co-authors of a forthcoming book called Queer Horror, a Film Guide, which is basically an encyclopedia of queer horror. There's 900 entries. I wrote about 80 of them. And it's exciting because there are a lot of really gay movies out there.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And also, I will also applaud that you were just on, I think it was Scream Dreams, the podcast, Catherine Corcoran, I think, and James A. Janisse. Loved that episode. That was really fun, too. So check that out on YouTube or podcatchers, wherever you get those. Love to see it. So Thanks. Seeing the gays thrive.
No, that was a lot of fun. And in fact, I had recorded with them back in August. They are very on top of their organization. So they backlogged a lot. It came out and then it just came out recently. So it was fun for me because you know how sometimes there's enough space between a conversation and when it comes out, you're like, oh, I did say that. Or we did talk about that. It's nice. Right.
Yeah, no, totally. Of course. Yeah. So yeah, Michael, I mean, I was aware of you probably most recently, I mean, from the Midnight Mass podcast, but also, I don't know, you kind of come into my understanding in the last few years, if anything. I thought, well, why not like try to maybe get him on the show? Hopefully we will have you back sometime this year as well. A little secret thing we're talking about in the background, because you just did some stuff recently with a release that's coming out. Can't talk about it right now, but you know, we'll see. There's anniversary you've been a part of for a movie that, you know, is beloved. So, but yeah, hopefully you'll be back for that. But yeah, I guess for me, if anything, or just for our listeners today, you know, we're talking about Idle Hands, right? So I want to know a little bit about, because we could just go on and on. I do want to ask about David Dakota and writing a movie for him, or The Wrong Stepmother. Like, ridiculous. But a little bit just to kind of get into this. What is it about Idle Hands? I did send you a list of movies that, you know, we could cover, but you chose this one. You were like, let's do this one. Let's start with this. And I just want to know, like, what's your history with this movie? Why do you like it? And why would you want to come on a podcast and talk about it, I guess? And then I'll give you my history, I guess.
Sure. I saw this movie when it came out in 1999. And one of the things that really attached me to it, and it's really, I think, important for listeners who are younger or maybe didn't grow up with the era of MTV that I did, to understand that MTV used to be very focused on music, obviously, music television, but they would go all in on certain movies in terms of like promoting them. It was like, this is like the youth movie, the counterculture. And for whatever reason, Idle Hands was one of those movies that kind of caught the attention of MTV and the MTV audience. And they highly publicized this movie on MTV. And I watched a lot of MTV at the time, so I got real jazzed up about it. And of course, you know, a lot of the players in the film, Devon Sawa, Teen Dream of a Generation, Seth Green, like if you grew up watching anything nerdy or anything fun, Seth Green was always there. Vivica Fox, Jessica Alba. This is a stacked cast. Eldon Henson is amazing. I love Jack Noseworthy. And so it was one of those films that I knew that I was going to see right away, but it immediately connected with me because coming from that era of stoner comedies, the Jays and Silent Bobs, Dazed and Confused, you know, even Cheech and Chong, if you were watching TBS late at night at a certain time, I was very into those kind of movies because those were the comedies of my preteen and teen years. But here's one that took the stoner comedy and brought it to the world of horror. And I think that was really special and it's really exciting. And I guess that maybe at the time I didn't realize, but something that you and I even talked about offline when we were planning this episode, it's kind of a little gay in a lot of different ways. Maybe not overtly, but there's a lot of interesting like homoerotic subtext. And I've always loved that. Maybe that's something I've always loved about the stoner genre in general. And I think that some people knowingly do it. Like Kevin Smith always wrote into those movies that Jay and Silent Bob were heterosexual life mates. That was like the language he would use. Like he knew what they were doing with that. And I think that you see this here with Seth Green and Eldon Henson's characters. And it was just everything I needed at the time. It's not too serious. It's a lot sticky. And it's wild.
Yeah, totally. I completely co-sign with what you're saying. You know, this movie for me was more of a recent watch. I think I watched it for the first time, like, back last year for the actual first time ever because it was streaming somewhere. I was familiar with it because you and me are a little bit different in age. You're only a little few years older than I am. But I, like you said, absolutely MTV kid, very much so. I was watching Daria when I was like a little kid, you know, and watching like Making the video and like all that. We were all about it. Watching the 20 somethings on MTV Spring Break, a moment. But so there's all that. But and it's, you know, what's surprising to me is that this is not an MTV film technically, because it so should be in a way. It's crazy to me. We were just talking a little bit because you will have heard I did Election last week from when you're hearing this. And it's so wild to me that like this movie was not an MTV movie. That was, though. And I was like, what? How does that happen? Like, you know, but it's just interesting to kind of think of that. No, you're absolutely right. Like, I think that this is an interesting intersection between those two genres, those stoner comedies that we really were only seeing so much of. Again, with Kevin Smith, he always kind of had that in part of his movies a bit. Like you said, Cheech and Chong and all that. But bringing it, and also, this is, of course, a little different than you could put it in like the post-Scream movies that came after that. But this is also very, it's different from that in a way, because this is overtly a comedy as opposed to those other films that really are these just post-Scream slashers that are aping off of the fact that Scream hit a certain time in a certain place. You know what I mean? But this is a little different than that, and we'll get into that. But yeah, I never seen this before. I was aware of it, but it just never seemed like it was a movie that I'd be that interested in, or I'm going to go and seek it out. But now that I have watched it, there are parts of it, and there are overall, I do generally enjoy it. Not my favorite movie. However, it's not the worst movie in the world. I understand if people completely hate this or completely love it, obviously. I think it's right in that sweet spot where I'm like, the actor's iconic, like the story is like so ridiculous and crazy. And I think if anything, I can appreciate what it's doing for sure.
Well, I like that you talked about it in regard to sort of the wake of Scream, like that post-Scream sort of landscape, because it is very different. But I also can see the studio's hand in, oh, you have to make sure this is a little like this. You know, we have the opening kill with Fred Willard. It is sort of the opening kill, but he's someone we know. We know him from comedies, from Christopher Guest movies. So he's sort of the Drew Barrymore of this film. And then utilizing that 90s horror kind of pastiche of having famous teen stars of the day. Whereas if you look at the 80s, it was sort of up and comers or unknowns, people who weren't on TV or known for other stuff. But what I really, really like about Idle Hands is it certainly falls in line with some of the post-Scream mold, but because it's not a slasher, it doesn't fall into the tropes of the post-Scream slasher. It's allowed to do things that horror at the time wasn't doing. Like, Scream wasn't a comedy, but it was a satire. And everything that followed was very much more serious, I guess. Like, I don't know that serious is the right word, but horror comedy that was released in the mainstream was few and far between. So to have a movie like this with like a Tiger Beat fave like Devon Sawa allowing himself to get gross, to get, you know, mutilated, that's wild. I mean, I think that it was a really great film for the moment and for the landscape of the end of the 90s.
Yeah, totally. I agree with that as well. I just think like it is a little bit different in what it was trying to do and, you know, overall what it was trying to, you know, have. And it's interesting because then you can kind of go off of like, of course, you know, the Faculty was around, but like that had been kind of like, so when I think of movies like The Faculty, that had already been written. And then because of the success of Scream, it got made. But they were already kind of like written it like 10 years before. Or even like I Know What You Did Last Summer, it's technically a book. You know what I mean? Or like these different things. So, you know, for this movie, like, I don't exactly know where it came from or where the idea of it came from. But it was just something where, yeah, I just think like it's doing something a little different. And then also like you'll see more horror comedies, this one included, but then also like right after this is Scary Movie. You then have The Hole that turns into that. Fun little thing too, I also just watched because it was on Vudu for free. I watched Shriek, If You Know What I Did Last Friday the 13th. God, that movie is so stupid, but I kind of enjoy it though for what it is. Like, I don't know. If you're juxtaposing it like to the Scary Movie movies, like, is it worse? Maybe a little bit, but like not by much though. Like, I don't know. So I just thought it was funny. I just watched that a few days ago. I was like, oh, okay, this isn't that bad. Like, it's not terrible. Like, you know, it is terrible, but it's like, I don't
know. Carmen Electra's in that, right?
No, she's in Scary Movie. This has Julie Benz in it.
Got it.
Oh, yes. And Simon Rex is there. It's a whole thing. So super fun. Anyway. Oh, I do also want to ask before we go into anything else. So as I stated in our wonderful intro that I did for you that you totally sent me beforehand. Yeah, you have written some movies and everything. I am fascinated and wondering, how did you write The Wrong Stepmother? And also, like, what was it like to be able to, I guess, in some way, shape or form, interact with one Mr. David Dakota? And yeah, what was that experience? experience like? I'm just curious because cult movies.
Sure. You know, what's funny is I do not get asked about this one all that often. But I know plenty of people are deeply fascinated with David. So, and justly so. I think if you grew up during a certain era, those Brotherhood movies on the shelves of your local Blockbuster or local video store were very alluring for a certain kind of audience. David and I were connected through a company called Hybrid. And Hybrid is a company that does a lot of movies for Lifetime and Hallmark and ION, TV movies, movies of the week, now kind of like streaming thrillers, streaming holiday films. And so the through line is I had been contacted several years before by Hybrid to write the first Christmas movie that is in sort of my canon of work. And that movie was a movie called A Christmas Reunion with Denise Richards. And it did well. Hybrid and I kind of kept a working relationship, and they had started making The Wrong series of movies, which became very much its own sort of juggernaut for Lifetime. And they were movies that David by and large wrote, by and large directed, and then Vivica produced. So yes. Vivica Fox, who of course is in
Idle Hands. Which is why she's in this movie, but then she's also in all those movies.
Exactly. I had actually, of course, I loved David's work growing up, watching USA Up All Night and renting movies at the video store. So I knew who he was. And Hybrid had this kind of really interesting circumstance where they were working with a lot of those directors of yesteryear, like Fred Olen Ray, who did Hollywood Chainsaw Hookers and Evil Tunes. He's the director of Christmas in Vermont, and he works with them and does like a lot of thrillers and holiday movies. Sam Irvin, who directed Elvira's Haunted Hills, has done a lot of Christmas movies with them. And David Dakota does a lot of Christmas movies and thrillers with them. And in addition to writing movies for them, I had fallen into a thing where I was doing some voice work on some of their movies. And I ended up doing a lot of voice roles in David's TV movies. So I actually have like voice acting credits on a handful of David movies. And we would encounter each other every so often. And I was always like, oh my God, I love you, you know, that kind of thing. And then Jeff Schenck, the producer that I work with there at Hybrid, was like, hey, we want to talk to you about writing a thriller. And as the thriller was manifesting, it became this like killer stepmother movie. And someone's like, well, it's got to be a Wrong movie. And I loved it because, you know, growing up watching horror movies with so many franchise entries, there was always sort of like a part of me that's like, I want to write like an entry in a franchise. I just didn't know that it was going to be the Wrong franchise, you know. And I'm thrilled to have written an entry in that series of movies. It was thrilling to have David direct it. And I also, if I'm not mistaken, and you know, maybe someone at Hybrid can correct me, but I was the first writer to have Vivica say the name of the movie in the movie, because there's a scene where she's encountering the wrong stepmother played by Cindy Busby, and she's like, blah, 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 blah. Well, if you think that, you're the wrong stepmother. And I thought it was funny, and I wrote it in the script, and they kept it. And then every Wrong movie after that, she says the line, you know, she says whatever the name of the movie is. So it was great. It was great to add to Vivica's amazing TV movie oeuvre and to write a movie for David. And we still interact every so often. I think he's phenomenal. He also is a workhorse. He's always making movies. He probably made 3 movies while we've been sitting here talking. That's just who he is.
No, literally, like, oh my God. He is somebody who is just fascinating to me because he knows how to do schlock, obviously, and some of his movies are detrimentally awful, but you can't help but look at them. Do you get what I'm saying? Like, because I've said before, like with some of his movies, like, you know that he just has some rich friend like in wherever the hell in LA who has a big house, and he's just like, all right, hot boy who's of age, come to this house and just walk around shirtless with these underwear, okay? And, you know, whatever, if that's the kind of movie you want to make, I'm not gonna yuck your gum, you know, whatever. It is very fascinating. And you're right, like, you know, these directors, they come from a certain generation that, yeah, you are putting stuff out. It was funny, I think it might be on my Tubi list, but I don't remember what it's called, but it's the wedding date movie with Marla Sokoloff that is literally directed by Fred Olen Ray, and I'm just like, one of these days I'm gonna press play on it, because Fred Olen Ray, the man that he is, with his oeuvre of film, of his films, but then also like just Marla Sokoloff's in this, like, what the hell? Like, it's a whole thing.
Well, and what's really great about Marla is that she has done a number of these movies for Hybrid, but now she's directing movies for them too.
Oh, you're
so
right.
She's become a filmmaker and a really good one. I know that she's directed a number of thrillers for them. I did voice work for one of her movies, and now I've got egg on my face because I don't remember what it was called. It's called
It's all good.
Paul Pass Nightmare, maybe? I think that's what it is.
I mean, something like that, whatever, you know, but it is this thing of like the generations that come from there. And that's where you have like the VHS boom of the 80s and these people who did direct to video, and they're just going to keep working and doing it because, you know, they have people who will watch their films, whether they're good or bad. Most of the time they're like not great, but like, there's still people, there's an audience for that. So, you know, and again, idle hands to a point can also be thrown into there too. Some people are like, this is so bad, it's good, or like whatever the hell, right? Yeah, I just thought I would ask about that because, again, gay stuff, cult movie stuff, I'm fascinated. So good for you getting that credit.
Thank you. And I will say before moving on, I think what's really interesting is that David Dakota is someone who was really a bridge for an era of queer horror. And by that, I mean, he was making movies with deep homoerotic subtext in an era where we weren't really getting queer horror outwardly at all. And so, you know, for queer fans of that time, to go and be able to rent Voodoo Academy or The Brotherhood or, you know, any one of the like 1313 movies, that was a really crucial transitional time for queer horror. And David was sort of the guy doing it. Whether people love his movies or not, it's undeniable that he was kind of giving audiences who were in need of like horny movies this gift. And, you know, straight audiences had horny horror movies forever. And so David was doing this thing and putting them on the shelves of video stores far and wide. And what's really kind of a bummer to me is that when we talk sort of about the history of queer horror, his name gets left out a lot, but he does. He really was there and did the work and made the landscape a little easier for those of us who came afterwards. So I'm always there to kind of like hype him up just a bit, because I think that he really, really did the thing. You know, whether people love everything he's done or not, I think the sheer volume of movies that David has made, if you're a gay horror fan, there's at least one that you're like, oh, but I like this one, or I like this one, I like this one. And that's cool. You know, that's cool.
It is. Yeah. I would say, I mean, I don't love Sorority Babes, for instance, but I love Nightmare Sisters because I don't know why. It's just like really fascinating to me. Why are these like three women just like walking around topless? Don't worry about it. It's all good. Like, you know,
David would tell you why not.
Why not? Exactly. I love also the fact that one of the men in that movie was absolutely a homosexual, and they had to kind of tell him to like tone it down. And he's also the same guy who I think also wrote Sweet Home Alabama. If that's not camp, I don't know what is. Like, literally, it's all good. But as we normally do on the show, we're going to go into a little bit of the figures of the movie, talk about like the release and like the reception and all that fun shit. We'll talk about the plot, characters. We're just going to chop it up, baby. It's going to be fun. So this movie came out August 30th of 1999. We'll talk a little bit about the release of this and, you know, whatever happened there. But this has come out right at the end of April, which is a little odd to me, but, you know, it's all good, whatever. I don't really know what the reason for that was, but, you know, things get released in the month that they're going to get released in, and whether it makes sense or not, I don't know. Then 92 minute runtime, so it does get in and get out pretty quickly and easily. This is a Sony picture, so, you know, big studio releasing this technically. And I don't know if you know like the exact budget information. I think this was estimated to be 25 million, maybe a little less than that, but still within that kind of mid-tier budget, if you will. Then the opening weekend, this came in at number 7 with about 1.8 million that it made in its first weekend. So not exactly the best, I guess, in terms of this. But again, I think there was a reason for that. And then ultimately, I believe this only made about $4.1 million on that big budget. And again, we'll probably talk a little bit about why that might have happened. If you want to talk about that now, we can. But, you know, Yeah, there's reasons for that.
It's interesting because I am always uncertain how to approach how the viewing audience takes things in. Like, I mean, mm-hmm. I'm a filmmaker. I write movies. I have had movies do well. I've had movies not do well. It's sort of the nature of the beast. And sometimes I think that you can kind of look at something and be like, all right, landscape wise, I get why maybe this didn't hit at this moment. Sometimes it's just like, you know, that them's the breaks and that just sucks. I think that if anything, the challenge of a movie like Idle Hands coming out in the wake of Scream, in the wake of movies like I Know What You Did Last Summer and The Faculty, Urban Legends, where everything was this super slick, serious kind of like, it's sexy and serious and like, oh no, the cast of Party in Five is going to die or whatever. And suddenly to be kind of thrown this curveball where there is no small degree of wackiness. Horror comedies often are met with resistance because there are air quotes horror purists, whatever that means, who don't like horror comedy. And then there are the people who maybe like comedy that don't want to go see gore in their comedy movie. And so it kind of complicates things a little bit in terms of what the heartland is going to go see. You know, I think that that makes it tricky. But a movie like this, which is so unapologetically what it is, and this is the truth of many cult films, it maybe doesn't find its audience right away. And that's why you can't measure its success on an opening weekend, because people are still talking about it. People are still seeking it out, because once it hits home video, it finds its people. I mean, you don't have 20th anniversary screenings of movies that no one's showing up to see. This year is the 25th anniversary of the movie. No, you know, and we're talking about it for that. Like, there's a reason. And so the mystery of why it worked at the box office or didn't work, I don't know. I just think that sometimes when things are not easily categorized, it's hard to sell a ticket. And I think that's just always the truth. And it's always going to be the truth, because people who are really into unusual cinema or niche cinema, they're open to taking a chance. But like, you know, I think about my aunts and uncles who are just like, they view movies as a distraction or an entertainment. And they want to like be able to look at the newspaper listing and be like, this is this and that's what it is. Great, here's my $5 or $10 or $20, whatever the case may be. The second they like look at it and they're like, I don't know what this is, boom, they're going to move on to the next thing.
Yeah, I completely agree with what you're saying, because I'm not in the film industry. If anything, I see myself as more of a curator. I'm not really a critic like that. I don't have the training to be, so I will tell you if I like something or not. But yeah, no, totally. I get what you're saying with this. I think also, we'll just kind of mention it now. So I think, to your point, yes, I think horror comedies, it's always met with like a question mark, if you will. I also think that this movie had the very unlucky position that it was in, where it was literally released like about 10 days or 9 days after the Columbine shooting. And it was also in the wake of that massacre, there was some gentleman, some U.S. government person who, of course, is coming down on all this violent media, and saying that, you know, well, this violent media, video games, movies, music, all of this is to blame, quote unquote, for this kind of massacre to happen. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, he even mentions Idle Hands by name, because it had just come out. So that doesn't help that, because then they're like, you know, you may have some people who are like, you know, yeah, no, you're not seeing this like movie. I'm not taking you to go see that movie. I think it's violent. I think it's this, because similar to how this is also pre 9/11, of course, but you know, people were also feeling a certain way after something like this happens, or when you have a tragedy, especially that it hits the nation. That's, I think, what also kind of happened with this. Same sort of thing happened with Ginger Snaps. Ginger Snaps went into production right before Columbine happened, and also another mass shooting in Canada happened, and it got barred, you know, where talent agencies were even like boycotting sending their talent out for that movie. So them's the breaks, like you said. It's just like, that's just the nature of the business, and it's what happens sometimes. So I think that also has to do with some of the box office, plus also, like, you know, when it comes to Rotten Tomatoes and stuff, which is really just an aggregate of it all, 16% by critics and 58% by audiences. also the critics of the time, even though I do think, yes, in a way, like this was kind of targeted towards horror fans, quote, I guess, but then also like young people, like young men, especially, because here's Jessica Alba, you know, and whomever. But like, you know, I also think that like, yeah, it's one of these things where you have these movie critics, a lot of whom are just old straight white men, not that many women either putting their voice into this as well. So that's why you have like a freaking 16% on Rotten Tomatoes or whatever, just because of the aggregate, because most people would say, no, this movie's stupid, like don't go and see it. But then you have on the flip side, no, you have people who do find it and who do like it, maybe just not at the time that it comes out. And then on the Voice of the People, Letterboxd says 3.2 out of 5. So, you know, again, I think there's people who like this for its ironic twist on the genre, and also just the boldness that it has to be this stoner comedy slash horror hybrid, if you will. But yeah,
I mean, I think that maybe the interesting thing about aggregate sites like Rotten Tomatoes is they are always going to convey what a very, very small group of folks think. In terms of the critical circle, horror has never really lived or died by critics. We know for a fact that critics, by and large, don't like the genre. And, you know, some of these movies that continue to endure were very, very poorly received by film critics when they came out. But it's through the passion of the fan base. And so I rarely ever take Rotten Tomatoes seriously, kind of in my place as sort of, you know, historian or curator of cult cinema, because some of the greatest movies, in my opinion, in the cult canon were not critically well received. Rocky Horror, of course, was a critical failure upon release. Showgirls was a critical and commercial disaster. But the thing is those movies were so unique that they just needed a minute. And when that minute happens, people find it again, the right people find it again who need that movie, and they keep the conversation going. I often say, you know, you can say what you want about Showgirls, but there are going to be people on the street, if you ask them what won Best Picture the year Showgirls came out, they don't know. But everybody knows Showgirls, whether they like it or not. And that's staying power. And movies like Idle Hands, maybe not quite to the degree of a Showgirls, of course, but Idle Hands, yeah, of course, was unfortunate in its box office returns on the opening weekend. It also came out during a terrible moment in history. It keeps getting rediscovered. And I think that when folks like Devon Sawa keep returning to horror, people want to see Devon's other horror works. And this is one of those that's kind of a curiosity, because it's not Final Destination. It's not Chucky. It's something totally different. And I think that that's the fun of it.
Yeah, I agree. I think like it's just interesting to see the people that do return to this movie and who do love it. And I completely agree with you, what you're saying with aggregate sites and just criticism kind of in general. I mean, that is why we have these like particular, that's why you have like Fangoria and Bloody Disgusting and stuff and Dread Central and all this, because even those publications skew towards a horror genre, obviously Fango being the one that's done it the longest because it was in print and everything. But still, yeah, it's being able to have fans of the genre be able to say, yes, we like this horror movie. No, we don't as a critic. And yeah, at the end of the day, if you like it, you like it. I absolutely wholeheartedly think like Jawbreaker is one of like the best movies ever. And Roger Ebert hated it, and it probably killed Siskel. You know what I mean? So it's like one of these things where it's like, if you feel like there's something more there, or if you feel like there is something where this is not as dumb of a movie as people think it is, that's the reason for my show, for you and Peach's show. I mean, that's what it is try to celebrate these things, talk about what works, talk about what doesn't. But at the end of the day, that's what it's for, really. And then we got to talk a little bit about our cast and crew. So this movie was directed by one Mr. Rodman Flender. If you don't already know who Rodman Flender is, he is also the uncle of Timothy Chalamet and Pauline Chalamet, by way of his sister, I believe, because yeah, it just is what it is. But he actually directed The Unborn and also Eat Brains Love, which is on Shudder at the moment, if you want to check it out. And he also did Leprechaun 2. Have you ever seen The Unborn? I feel like I'm asking an obvious question, but have you seen that movie?
I have. Yeah. I think that it was one of those that I rented back in the day. My memory of it isn't as strong, but I can picture the cover art. I remember it quite well.
Yes.
No, it is funny, us recording not too long after St. Patrick's Day. It's early April right now. Mm-hmm. But I always love around St. Patrick's Day, one of the bits of trivia people love to bandy about. They'll be like, oh, the director of Leprechaun 2 is Timothée Chalamet's uncle. And I'm like, okay, why can't we say the director of Idle Hands is Timothée Chalamet's uncle, you know?
I'm going to say, right. Like, yeah. Does it have to wait till 420? Really, everybody? Come on.
Exactly. I mean, not that I have anything against Leprechaun 2. I don't. I quite enjoy that one. I love seeing the leprechaun on the mean streets of Los Angeles. And it's fun. But whenever someone has a famous relative who comes from the world of horror, I always like to imagine, like, has Timothée Chalamet sat down and watched Idle Hands? Has Timothée Chalamet watched Leprechaun 2? And I would like to think so, you know?
I'd hope that is one of those things that he just, like, found and his uncle was just like, yeah, I did do that. That happened. Like, okay. But yeah, so he also came from, like, the Roger Corman school. So he actually, at one point or another, I think it was New World Pictures or somewhere, he became like a vice president of distribution or something like that very, very quickly. And he also, similar to how a lot of people came up after Roger Corman or came up with him, under him, he's one of them. So, you know, he's in the business of being able to make something out of not a whole lot, because that's the Roger Corman way. And God love him for it. The writers of this movie are Terry Hughes and Ron Milbauer. I don't know if you can glean any information, because you did do a 20th anniversary screening at Rooftop Cinema Club. Shout out Movies That Made Us Gay. Also got to do that for Jawbreaker. Love that for them. And friends of the show, of course. Do you have anything to glean from, like, these writers? Because I have no idea what else they did, or maybe how the story came to be, if you know anything that I was able to find out.
You know, I don't know a lot actually about the writing of the script, other than, of course, it was born out of that idiom of Idle Hands, or the Devil's Playground, which of course is in the movie as well. And I think that that's one of those things. Stephen King always says that the best horror ideas always come from you just sitting around thinking, wouldn't it be funny if. And they probably were like, oh, Idle Hands or the Devil's Playground. Wouldn't it be funny if they actually were? And that's where this movie came from. But I know this movie, in terms of its trajectory to being shot, had a little bit of a journey, because from the time of the writing of the script, there were some production woes where Rodman Flender was not the first director attached to it. I think he was the third. They went through like two directors in the process of getting to him. I think that it's just one of those where it was in development hell for a while. And maybe along the way, some of the details about how the script came about have been lost to time, because we now focus on the making of the movie and the onset, director switcheroo. And yeah, I wish I knew more about those guys, because I think they wrote a funny script.
Yeah, I believe so. And of course, like, you're going off of like that idea and everything. But of course, like, then you also have the popularity of something like the Adam Sandler movies that also has like a literal, like, a disembodied hand. So why not turn that into a killer? You know what I mean? Who, of course, we'll talk about that in the cast, of course. But yeah, no, I wish I knew a little bit more about this. And there isn't much that I was able to find in terms of like, here's how we wrote the movie. Like, here's what came to be. Composer of this movie is tried and true Graham Revell. So he's done a lot of different movies. Not just this one, but also Sin City, From Dusk Till Dawn, The Craft. But he's done plenty of other films as well. So tried and true Graham Revell. Steven Rivkin is the editor of this movie. He did Avatar, so he worked with James Cameron before. And also My Cousin Vinny. So he did that before this, of course. Cinematographer of this movie, there you go, is Chris Balfa. He did actually the sequel to Friday, which is next Friday, and then he also did the, I don't know who directed it, it was either produced by Ryan Murphy, I don't think he directed it, he might have, the Augustine Burroughs adapted movie of Running with Scissors with Evan Rachel Wood. Do you have anything else in terms of any of the other crew members of this movie that you want to like shout out or any of that kind of stuff?
No, I think that's great. In terms of all of the folks involved. I mean, yeah. I think that Graham Revell's music in this is really wonderful. I was really paying attention to it in this last revisit for mm-hmm. the podcast. The music of this movie is very befitting of the generation. And I think what I like most about Graham Revell is he really taps into the vibe of what the script needs, you know, mm-hmm. his score for The Craft is not this, you know.
Absolutely.
The Craft is like this awesome, you know, female empowerment, like the mysticism, and you like with the chimes and the score. And this movie is about like a loser. And he's just like, all right, we're gonna have like lots of punk music and like punk chords. And I think it works. So really excellent work from him.
Yeah, I agree. And then some of the cast of this movie, as we already kind of mentioned. So Devon Sawa, who at this point had been in Casper, he was also in A Favorite of Mine, Now and Then. Love that. But he would then go on to be in, you know, the Chucky series. He would then be on Final Destination the year after this. So probably they shot this sometime. We'll probably talk about it, but they probably shot this like year before, if you will. And then they were shooting in 1999 for Final Destination, so he was on a cycle, baby. And you also got to meet him at the screening that you did, which is cool.
Yes.
And then Seth Green, as we all know from the miniseries, creator of Robot Chicken, Can't Hardly Wait, Josie the Pussycats. I mean, he's a king among kings, a short king to marvel at, truly and utterly. And I love him. Buffy, like everything. He would have been a draw for sure. I think him from being in Buffy, and then just Devon Sawa for the girls of being like, what is this stupid movie with Devon Sawa in it? You know what I mean? Like, why not?
Yeah, this movie would have come out during the third season of Buffy,
right?
Yeah. So that's you know, great crossover. Mm-hmm. It also explains Oz's absence for a little bit in the Buffy.
Correct. Yes, that's true. And then you have Eldon Henson, who I think had a pretty good year this year. He's from the Mighty Ducks movie, or at least one of them, I think, as a lot of people came out of those movies. That and The Sandlot, like, kind of had this like Marley Shelton would come out of that and like all this. But he had a good 1989 because he, before this movie, he was in She's All That earlier in the year of Super Bowl weekend at that time. And then he's in this movie playing a completely different character. And yeah, that's kind of what he's pretty much been known for. It's like these like two or three movies he's been in. I'm sure he's done other TV work and stuff like that, but I think he'll always kind of be remembered as like, oh yeah, like Lainey's fat friend, quote unquote, you know, or like Penub from this movie or whatever.
Right.
Jessica Alba, who doesn't really talk about this movie whatsoever, but it was one of her kind of early roles. She's been in Sin City, Knocked Up. We'll never let her forget that she was on The Secret World of Alex Mack back in the day. She was on there. It happened. And as you said, Vivica A. Fox is in this movie as well. She's from Set It Off, fantastic, wonderful movie. I do have in my notes The Wrong series that you just explained that she is a producer on those movies, so that's why she's in all of them.
I believe she's in 18 of those movies, if I'm not mistaken.
Absolutely. If I was backing those ones, I'd be in every single one to get that money. She's always getting to the bag, and I can't hate her for it.
You know what? It is genius, you know, to kind of create the work that you want to see, and she's always out there like really peddling her wares in a great way. What I love about The Wrong mm-hmm. series is it's, you know, Vivica will be on The View and The Talk and like all mm-hmm. of these like major talk shows talking about it. And that's just amazing to me. I wanted to comment briefly on you mentioning that Jessica Alba doesn't really talk about this movie a lot. I love Jessica Alba, and I think she's great in this movie. And there's like no shame in her being in it. But in a way, I understand, because her character is not really present in this film a lot. This is definitely a boys' movie.
Oh, completely.
The core relationships with the guys, she's sort of like the hot neighbor next door. We don't really know a lot about her until the third act with the school dance. And then it's sort of like, if my memory serves, she kind of went from this. And then did she get Dark Angel this same year? It's like a huge television show that James Cameron produced.
Something like that. Yeah. Like not too long after this.
Yeah. So, I mean, like if I'm going from like fourth build in a teen movie that I don't have a lot to do to the lead of a James Cameron produced series, my memory of 1999 is going to be different as well, you know?
For sure. For sure. Yeah. Is she the one who also has The Honest Company? Is that her? I feel like I get her and some other lady mixed up.
I don't know, actually. I wish I did.
Yeah. The little Honest Company where they make like baby wipes or whatever the hell. Yeah, all those things. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I got to bring up, because he's probably the only real homosexual in this movie, even though I have my thoughts of Micah Penub, is Jack Noseworthy, which, a king among kings. I want to see him in more things. He was in the cinematic art that is the Brady Bunch movie. I'm waiting for you and Peaches to do it. I'm waiting.
You know what? You are not the first person this weekend to ask me if we would ever do the Brady Bunch movies.
So. I'm just saying. Like, I'm just saying, but I'm just waiting for it. And then also in Cecil B. DeMented as well. You know, just Barb Wire. He's Pamela Anderson's like brother in that movie. Homosexual forever and ever. Was out when he made this film. Like, has a husband and everything. Again, because of the way of our world right now, I always would have remembered that, like, we were always here. So it was very important. And yeah, I really like his character. I wish he worked more. I wish he just had more roles. He was more notable, if anything.
What I really like about Jack Noseworthy, too, especially when you talk about actors, you know, there's always that argument of should straight actors play gay characters? And then in this reverse way, what I really love about Jack Noseworthy is he was out. But if you look at the run of characters, even in the movies you reference, he not only often plays straight guys, but he plays like the most bruiser of straight guys and these like punk dudes, or like the dude that like the lead character is like, oh, he's going to beat me up. And I love that that's him, because it's sort of like the flipping of the script. It makes him kind of like his own cult hero in a way.
Absolutely. Like, because literally, like, all four of those roles I just said are pretty interchangeable, I feel like, because he's the Dittmeyer's son. He's the brother of Pamela and Barb from Barb Wire. He's in this movie as Randy. And then he's in Cecil B. DeMented as one of the people who is, because you guys just covered that movie on Midnight Mass too. But, you know, he's in there with like Maggie Gyllenhaal and like all the people and Alicia Witt and whatever. But yeah, it's just like they're all a little interchangeable, but I do like that he's doing that different thing, you know, and we only had so many of them at this time. It's him and BD Wong that kind of like, because BD Wong was literally in a multi-million dollar like movie series, so you know, that helps. Also being an Asian doing that was super cool. This is just a white gay guy, which we like to, but again, you know, it's one of those things where it's cool to see that kind of doing it, and it's not a forefront. You know, again, we're all queer up in here, baby. So we love that. But it's cool to see that. And I just don't want him to ever be forgotten. I really like him. And, you know, he seems like a cool cat. Is there anybody else? We did talk about Fred Willard, of course. Amazing. Connie Ray plays the mom in this movie. They get taken away pretty quickly in the film. Are there any other cast members that you kind of wanted to shout out or anything like that?
I mean, the one cast member, and it's barely a cast member, it's a cameo at best, but like growing up during the MTV era that I did, I love that there is a cameo from Tom DeLonge from Blink-182 in this movie, when our Anton, played by Devon Sawa, is trying to talk to Jack Noseworthy at the drive-thru. He runs in, and the kind of like California stoner that's working at the drive-thru that Devon Sawa is like, you're off, you can take your break, and the dude's like, all right, that's Tom DeLonge from Blink-182, and it's amazing. Because talk about like a throwaway cameo that you just know he was like, I want to be in this horror movie about a stoner whose hand is possessed by the devil. I love it. Love it. Love it.
Yeah, very fun. Like, it's real cute. Katie Wright is in this movie, who plays Jessica Alba's friend. I don't remember her name. Tamara, I think it is, or something like that.
Tanya. It was Tanya.
Yes. I knew it started with a T. There you go. Yeah. But yeah, so there was that, you know, all of this. So yeah. And then in terms of like the production of this movie, so of course it was, I don't know if you have any information to give about like the production, the filming and all this. I do love that this was the high school at the end of this movie is both the Buffy school from the original movie with Christy Swanson, bleh, but it's still an iconic movie. So it's the gym from that. And also in, I already said, it's My Casablanca, Jawbreaker. This is where it all goes down at the end. That's where the Donnas are. That's where they're throwing the corsages. This is the same place. Cause literally Darren Stein had to go to like three different schools in that whole movie to shoot the movie. But I just love that they also use it in here. Do you know anything about this school, what else it's been in or anything like that? Or do you have any fun things about production that you may have found that I didn't already chair.
For horror fans, I can tell you that the neighborhood where Anton lives in the movie is South Pasadena, which is also the neighborhood that John Carpenter shot Halloween, the original 1978 Halloween. And in fact, the house that Anton lives in is just like right around the block from the Michael Myers house in the Jamie Lee Hedge scene. So that's kind of one of those fun production things. If you're over in South Pass, it just looks like every suburban horror movie from the 70s and 80s, because it's both Southern California, but also all the shrubbery is very like Midwest. And I'm sure in a movie town, that's by design. And it's cool to walk around because you'll be like, oh yeah, this is where, PJ Souls and Jamie Lee Curtis ran into Michael Myers. And there's where Devon Sawa ran over Vivica Fox. You know, it's amazing. So it's just, speaking of kind of crossover in terms of shooting locations, that's one of the gifts. Because you go from Haddonfield to Ronald Reagan High, right?
Like, literally, it's so funny. Yeah. And it's so good. Ronald Reagan High. Oh, my God. Just put it all out there. I love it. But yeah, no, totally. And yeah. And so since you did do the 20th anniversary screening back when this turned 20, do you have any fun little tidbits or anything? Because you did get to have Rodman Flender and the three leads of this movie, really, Devon Sawa, Seth Green, and Eldon Henson there. There's a whole little video on YouTube that if you all want to watch it, it's like them talking about it a little bit. You hear Michael's voice in it. It's real cute.
That's how I learned that there's a video. I didn't know there was a video out there.
There is. It's the Rooftop Cinema Club. They have like a little YouTube channel, I think. And one of the videos they have is like the probably pro stuff that you and or the actors did beforehand, where they talk about like Seth Green talks a little bit and like Eldon Henson talks a little bit or whatever. But it's a cute little video. I'm not going to look it up right now and tell you how many views it has. It probably has a few hundred. But
no, that was a really great night. And I will actually tell you the jawbreaker of it all. That came about because for the 20th anniversary of Jawbreaker, they had done a screening. Because I know the Movies That Made Us Gay guys also did a rooftop cinema screening of Jawbreaker. Well, before that, I had done one with Darren, Rebecca Gayhart, and Julie Benz. And it was one of those that was facilitated, all credit and props to Darren Stein, because they had asked him to screen the movie for the 20th anniversary. Darren's a friend of mine, and he was like, hey, 11th Hour, could you come host this Q&A for me? And I was like, sure. And while I was there, I had started talking to the programmer, and he was just like, do you like this movie, Idle Hands? And I was like, do I like Idle Hands? And he was like, yeah. He was like, well, if you want to come do that one too. So I feel like I had like the run of the 1990 20th anniversaries all shot in that high school. Maybe I'm connected to that high school. And it was really great because, as you mentioned, Devon Sawa, Seth Green, Eldon Henson, and Rodman Flender were there. A lot of the stories they told are all pretty public knowledge. I don't think there's anything that like I'm going to shock anybody or break new ground. But what I really liked, because I spent time with them before we went up on stage, was just listening to how quickly they fell back into this kind of joyous camaraderie. Because, you know, sometimes movies are just like any other jobs, you know, not to disillusion folks out there who don't work in the industry. There are people you work with that you, keep in touch with forever. And then there are people you do a gig with, and then just because life happens, you kind of fade away, or like, you know, some connections are stronger than others, et cetera, et cetera. But they all seemed to genuinely like each other. And when they started talking about this movie, it was almost like, oh, creating that vibe with those three guys must not have been a stretch, because watching them immediately kind of fall into this sort of like dudes hanging out on the couch. In a way, it was sort of like Devon, Seth, and Eldon were just like partying, and Rodman and I were also present, like, you know, in that kind of way, which I loved. And I thought that was great. Rodman Flender spoke a bit about coming in and the challenges of kind of reshaping the movie to what he wanted to see as a director. And they all spoke a little bit about dealing with the fact that it didn't land immediately upon coming out. But then I think there's that thing that happens when you have a minor disappointment and 20 years later, you get to be on the roof of a cinema with all these people who are jazzed. So I think that's the great joy of cult cinema, to get to watch these folks who made these things we love in turn realize that what they made really means something to people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as time goes on and people get older, it's just important to make sure that they know that, you know, and that they're aware of it. I know people have probably seen it on Instagram, but like gay Instagram, and I'm sure gay Twitter as well. Of course, like not all of us because we can't all be there, but the Academy of Museum in LA just did the screening of Showgirls. And Elizabeth Berkley did the intro to that when they screened it there. And again, I think it's just something where, you know, as people get older, you know, obviously people like from the older days, like the people who are involved, there are some people who are still involved with like Night of the Living Dead who are still alive, but a lot of them have passed away. A fair amount of the people from like Professor Pussycat Kill Kill and like these older movies maybe didn't know the impact that they had all the time because they just weren't aware of it or they just had died already. But knowing that like someone like an Elizabeth Berkley who's ultimately her career was ruined by that film and she had to rebuild it in a way, no fault of her own, but understanding that she has had like a reclamation of this character and of this movie and can see it as something positive, and knowing that we weren't laughing at you because you're a bad actress, we're laughing at your commitment to this character who's ultimately a flawed person, but know that we still love you as this actress. And again, it's one of those things where I think as time goes on, it's just important for folks to know that because, yeah, these are movies that weren't loved when they were, you know, coming out and they were ripped apart. So,
yeah. And, you know, for all of the wickedness that can come from the terminally online, you know, I think that the internet is a blessing and a curse. But in the case of the turnaround of fandom, there is something nice about the fact that we folks involved in these movies can see a lot quicker than they used to be able to. I mean, it took Elizabeth Berkley nearly 30 years to really fully understand because, you know, the bubble that she was in the post-Showgirls release was very negative and very bad. But then look at something like Jennifer's Body, which did not have a great release and was beaten up. I think, you know, Diablo Cody and Karen Kusama and Megan Fox were able to see much quicker that people loved it because the internet was very vocal about it after a few years. And I think that that, if anything, is really great about cult fandom is now there's a lot more of an easy way to connect with the other people who love these movies. Whereas back in the day, it was like if I rented Phantom of the Paradise at my local video store in small town Colorado, it may take me another 8 years before I meet someone else who even knew what it was. And that was always great, though, because then you're like, oh, I found my people. But like, I can't imagine what it would have meant to me, like going online in like 1987 and being like, I just saw Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, and someone else being like, I love that, you know? So I think that that is a big game changer. And for as frustrated as I get with the landscape of film criticism online and film fandom online, to be fair, there is a lot of good as well. And I think that it's been really great because I know if you follow Devon Sawa on Twitter, he loves horror and he loves that people love him in horror. And it means something to him that when people like Final Destination or Idle Hands or Chucky. And, you know, Rodman Flender did a lot of TV and is really prolific television director. But I'm quite certain that Eat Brains Love came about because people wanted him to make another horror movie. And, you know, he could, you know, look to the ongoing cult success of something like Idle Hands and be like, let's do this. And in fact, that was what was happening right around the time of the Rooftop Cinema Club. They all talked about their recent projects and he had just had that come out. And that was exciting to hear because he hadn't made a horror film in a while. And it is, I think it's just that audience connection is really special.
Yeah, totally. So we did talk about the cast and the crew of this movie and how it came out, you know, even to a point, kind of the cult status it's received and everything. But Michael, I have a task for you. So if you could give us maybe a little bit of a TLDR, if you will, kind of a thing of Idle Hands. If you had to kind of pitch what this movie is about to somebody who's maybe never seen it, how would you like describe what this film is?
This movie is about Anton, a kid who lives in a California suburb who is the most underachieving stoner of all time. And by being this absolute loser, idle hands being the devil's playground, his hand becomes possessed by the devil himself. And he is not initially aware because he's too ripped on bong rips. And he accidentally kills his two best friends and his stoner buddies who come back as zombies to kind of help him in his plight. Meanwhile, a bitchin' nun warrior woman played by Vivica Fox, whose job is to track down the devil who's hand hopping, is on her way to California to kill this kid, but it may not be all that too easy.
Exactly. There you go. There's the good old Michael Verratti, introductions, or you're known for your introductions on your previous podcast. and also just being able to kind of summarize a movie. So yeah, it's pretty much what it is. I love that. This is kind of the intersection of possession. There's a little bit of zombie in there, and it's all just kind of wrapped up in this crazy kooky, package, really. I totally co-sign on that. I guess for me, do you have a particular favorite character in this movie or anything? Or what do you think of some of these characters in the film? And we can talk a little bit about them, but do you have a favorite or anything?
It actually is the easy answer, but I think that Anton is my favorite character because there is this thing that is sort of hard to explain in retrospect of the quintessential 90s boy. And he was the quintessential 90s boy. He had kind of the baggy clothes, the sort of a little bit glazed over, but glazed over in the way that you're I want to hang out and go eat tacos with that dude, and he just seemed like the every guy. I knew a lot of those guys when I was growing up. When I was a teenager, a lot of people like Anton were friends of mine. So I probably would have been, smashed in the head with a bottle if that had happened in my life. I think that Devon Sawa plays that character great. And what I really, really like about him as that character is coming off of movies like Now and Then and Wild America and, these films that really cast him as teen heartthrob. It's not that he's not a heartthrob in this movie. He's still the male lead. He's still the romantic lead for Jessica Alba. But there's just something funny to me where you take this person who is widely perceived as sort of a teen sex symbol and just make them a grungy stoner. I just think it's really fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a toss up with me. So I do like Anton as a character. I think Devon Sawa does a really good job at this. It's kind of a more fleshed out thing of heroin Bob. I think he played him or whoever he played in SLC Punk. He also reminds me a little bit of him. Yeah. Just a little bit. And then he's is literally displaced on the street in that movie, which is very unfortunate and sad. And Matthew Lillard feels a certain way about that in that film. But I'm going to do that movie at some point. I love that movie so much. But anyway, so yeah, but it's that. I have to say it's kind of a toss up, and I guess I'm cheating a little bit. I think my favorite characters, even if they're a little problematic, somewhat, I really do Mick and Penelope's characters. I think they're just the kind of quintessential, and it works for these actors because they are the kind of quintessential friends, supporting friends. I just think their dynamic is really funny, and they're just kind of these chuckleheads that follow him around and are his friends. And as we've already kind of stated before, they are absolutely undercover gay for one another. Even the last film, the last scene of this film is let's go walk through a nurse or whatever. Oh, be careful. Some of them are guys. And I'm obviously y'all are so gay for one another. I'm just saying, but I like their vibe with each other for sure.
I mean, this is also Seth Green doing what Seth Green does best, right? If you look at that era of his work, he plays versions of this character, and this is not a bad thing. This is what we want from him. That kind of dude who's just a little bit extra in his not coolness, and that's what makes him cool. He's the stoner here that he wouldn't be popular at school, but he's instantly the most likable character in the movie. In Can't Hardly Wait, he's the guy who tries too hard that makes Lauren Ambrose fall in love with him. It's that thing. He in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, it's that effortless I'm not trying, and that's what makes you love me. In a way, I think that his character here is sort of the pinnacle of all of the Seth Green characters. There's a little Oz here. There's a little of the character in Can't Hardly Wait. There's a little Dr. Evil's son. You know, there's all of that. And I think that it's such a good character for him. And his chemistry with Eldon Henson is so good that you're right. It's sort of like they are Jay and Silent Bob. They're hetero life mates. They are also not maybe that hetero. You know, there's something about it that's just really cute. But I think that's just like that vibe. Like, he's so good at fostering chemistry with his you know, castmates that I love it. I love it.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think, like, and you were saying to me before, probably like a day ago or so, that stoner comedies have this interesting ability to kind of, it always feels a little queer with them. And I'm also the one who absolutely thinks, like, you know, Bill and Ted, even though they're not stoners technically, they're absolutely like heterosexual life partners, like completely and utterly. But it's one of these things where it's like, you know, maybe it's also because, like, of being a queer person, like, you have a lot of your own headcanon where you kind of take these characters and you just see that of like, hey, no, it does feel like there is that, or like, you know, it's just the vibe that I get off of there. Also, I think if anything, Seth Green's probably doing just fine, but like, I would love for him to do more work in terms of maybe dramatic or whatever. I think he's great comedically, but also like, I think any drama work he does would be really good. I fully stand that like, Party Monster is not a really good movie, really, honestly. However, he's like the best part of that film because, and he said this before, and like, I think it was either GQ or Vanity Fair or something. He said that a lot of his characters he's played, he always tends to bring, like you were saying, he plays these kinds of characters that are uncool, but then because of that, like, they're able to kind of turn it into being cool. I think he has said that he brings a heart to a lot of these characters that sometimes you wouldn't think of, really. And so James St. James, for who he is and his kind of, you know, whatever part he played in that kind of club kid scene, I saw that in that movie in particular, he brought a heart to him that, whether or not that exists in the real James St. James, I don't really know. I don't know him, but it's just a different kind of thing in that movie alongside someone like Macaulay Culkin. And he's a standout to me in that film. And I know he's produced some other things. He's been in some other stuff, but I want him to have his little Brendan Fraser moment, like, cause I think he's, you know, I don't know, like, not that he's going to win an Oscar, but I just want him to be seen. It's him and Matthew Lillard. You know, I think they're really also, they were in a movie together, funny enough, but like, you know, the sequel to Scooby-Doo, but like, you know, it's one of these things where I want them to get their due because I think they're very talented actors who, you know, have been doing this forever and they have their fandoms, but I also think, like, whether it'll happen or not, I want them to get that critical success, if anything. They have their own success, of course, but I want it to be more recognized because I think they're truly, really good.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think that the thing about Seth Green, especially, is he knew and continues to know what the perception of his kind of persona is to the world. It's why Robot Chicken works, right? Robot Chicken has that very kind of definitive Adult Swim, like, this is something for stoners at 3 a.m. And he leans into that, but I think that it's very cunning and clever in the way that he does. Like, it's earnest, but he knows how to play the character that the world thinks of him as. But he has also played many, many characters that prove his breadth of talent is quite big. And I would like to see him kind of get a renaissance.
I completely agree. I think you mentioned it a little earlier, and it is one of these things where I think it's been a little itty bit of a stain on this movie, but it's not the worst thing. Is the character of Molly, played by Jessica Alba. And the thing is, I can't even take credit for this, like, because I did hear this before on actually the Dead Meat podcast, because they talked about how they watched this movie before on like a lightning round, like, movie reviews that they did, where they talked about a bunch of movies that they watched in a month. And I will say that I do agree with what they said on that pod, where her character is very incidental in this movie. you know? She's the hot neighbor who Anton's been crushing on this whole time. But I also just think, like, it comes out of nowhere, kind of what she, her part in this, because she's kind of the, not the sexually aggressive one, but she's the one who's like, oh, I'm glad you finally took your shot. And I'm like, where did that come from? He doesn't even know you. Like, what? And I think it's always been sort of a little bit of a stain where people are like, yeah, I don't know what the hell's going on between her and Anton. Like, this is just this. Feels weird to me.
Yeah, I mean, I look at it from two different points, right? I think that I don't think that Jessica Alba was given enough to do. I don't think it's a very realized character. And I think that it's absolutely the right read that, you know, she's underdeveloped in terms of, you know, story and character content. That being said, I kind of, you know, when we look at elements that would be problematic of films of yesteryear, there's sort of like taking into kind of the landscape of cinema. This is just kind of what happened in stoner movies of back then. And that doesn't make it right. But like, I think I would be more mad if they did it now because we know better. And we now have so many years of like looking at movies like this and being like, no, get it together, be better. That I think that when I watch this, I'm kind of like, ugh, I wish we had had more Jessica Alba, but I'm not, it doesn't bump me that I'm just like sitting here like, well, I can't watch this movie because Jessica Alba's character is not, you know, a completely realized character. I mean, like, in truth, they're all cartoons. I mean, this movie, like Vivica Fox, the other female lead, dynamic though she may be, and she gets all the best action, she gets the fight stuff, but like her one motivator is stab hand, then sex. I mean, like that's what she wants to do. And like, that's the boys too. Rip bongs, sit on couch. No one is actually developed. And that maybe is what makes it all work.
I can agree. Yeah, for sure. I like that point. And it's back to what the Debbie podcast said. It would have made a lot more sense if they had like, if they were already friends, maybe. Like, I think that would have made sense. Or maybe they were already dating and this was just somebody that like, you know, yeah, whatever. I like the friends idea more, really. Like, if they were already just kind of friends, but they live next to each other, but he's been in love with her the whole time. You know what I mean? And I don't know. I could definitely have seen that, too, for sure. I agree with what you're saying. I think, like, it's just underwritten. Everyone's kind of a caricature in this whole movie, which is totally fine. But it's one of those things where, you know, I think if anything, like the stain of the movie is maybe that if people just feel like what the hell is going on with this character. But then also like, you know, just the kind of utter ridiculousness of the movie, I think is a hard sell for some people as well, where they're like, yeah, no, this movie's not that good or whatever it is. Now, I will say, so a little bit about... You went over like the baseline plot or whatever, but you're probably already aware of this. This movie actually had a bit of a different ending, and we can talk a little bit about that. So are you aware of the alternative ending of this movie?
Yeah, I slightly recall that there's a different ending. So why don't we dig into that? I need a refresher.
Sure. Sure. Okay. So for anybody who wants to look it up, so on YouTube, you can look this up, the Idle Hands alternative ending. So the way that this movie ends is that Jessica Alba is on top of a car and it's being like lifted up into like a pentagram that's about to squish her, right? And then Devon Sawa's character, he has to come and save her. The actual ending of this movie is that, and what ends up happening is that, like you said, Debbie LaCure comes in and like throws a knife, the knife that she's going to kill this hand with. It stabs Mick in the chest and like, again, the hand dies. But even that was like, you know, they had the whole line of like, oh, no, like this, no, like that. And that was because this was a reshot ending, because the original ending was actually in the school's pool, I believe.
Right, right.
And it was literally Jessica Alba, Molly, on the diving board, and the hand is like trying to get her and all this shit. And it's funny, Rodman Flender does a whole intro to this because it was probably a bonus feature. I think it is a bonus feature, probably on that collector's Blu-ray that came out from Scream Factory a couple years ago. But it is, and he kind of talks about this, but you see more of the CGI and the visual effects of the movie, because they pretty much have opened a portal to hell in this swimming pool. And that's what they have to save Molly from, pretty much, in all of this. And then there's a stairway to heaven that comes, you know, after, like in the movie as well. So that's like the baseline idea. So pretty much it goes from all these VFX and CGI thing that's a lot more horrifying, if anything, right? And it's in line with the horror of this movie. But then you then get, because I guess that ending just didn't work for whatever reason, or it just didn't. I think they even said, I think Robin Flender and some of the team said that the tone was just a little different in that ending than what the movie was up to that point. So that's what they went with, this other ending that we have currently now. But it, like, it is interesting that. Yeah.
Yeah. No, no. I now. Yeah, you're right. This reminds me of the information about the alternative ending. And one of the things that I also understood about it was that it was just going to go like vastly over budget as well. Like the idea of pushing it into that space, but also to have this big, like, hell mouth kind of like epic ending is not really what this movie is. You know, I love that the whole defeat of the hand is the throwing of the knife and it just like pops, you know, and then leading to the whole conversation, like, that's it. Yeah, it is it, because this is a movie of underachievers. So, of course, like, it's an underachieving sort of ending. And that's like by design. I think it works. I think that if it like suddenly turned into the like final scene of like a season finale of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, that doesn't work because Anton's not that person. Those stoners are not those people. They're not going to save the day in like a giant hellscape. You know, Anton's solution to having like a wonky hand was to try and cut it off using a bagel slicer. He's not the brightest person, you know. Like, I think that having it be kind of like a, oh, great kind of ending is hilarious. It's just like that falls in line with the comedy of it all.
Yeah, and I think that's what they kind of realized. And again, for the people who do like it, you know, that's great and everything. But like, people who like the original ending that they were going to do, that's great. But like, yeah, it is different than what we were doing up to that point, for sure. Right. So, yeah, that's a little bit about that, too. Do you have any particular like standout scenes or anything like that that you can remember from this film that you just have just kind of stuck with you, or that are your favorite scenes?
The scene that I remember most distinctly from when I was a teenager, even though it's very quick, because, and it might have even been used in the promo, or there was some reason that this just stuck with me, is after the hand is separated and they get to the school dance, when the hand is sharpening its fingers in the pencil sharpener. I just always thought that was so cool. I don't know. I think once the hand is separate from Anton, we have to give, you know, props to Evil Dead 2 for kind of covering this territory before. It's sort of like the stoner version of Evil Dead 2, although I would argue that Evil Dead 2 is the stoner version of Evil Dead 2, because you get a lot of this slapstick hand humor that happens. And I love all of that. And I think that the hand kind of going nuts in the school, everything that happens in that sequence, I just love. I love the sharpening of the fingers and the pencil sharpener. I love when the hand rips off the scalp of Dexter from The Offspring. I think that that's all just like really great, really 90s imagery. And that just brings me a lot of joy.
Yeah, totally. I think like those are some pretty good scenes as well. I do like the whole dance at the school. Like, that's always just like such vibes, really. I love that. And then also the fact that it's the Buffy and Jawbreaker school, I just really like that. But even like, yeah, anything with Micah Penub as well. Like, I love when, like, obviously their deaths respectively are just so ridiculous and crazy that I can't help but enjoy them. But also I like them coming back from the dead as well. I think they're just very funny, and that really goes with the comedy of this film, which I just appreciate. But yeah, those are kind of like the standouts for me, if anything. And I also like that this movie also just uses a lot of, there is a good amount of gore in it as well. I really can appreciate that. And there's a fair amount of slapstick gore going on, which I can always really get into as well. And also, like, even though, yeah, there is a level of, I guess, some sort of CGI in this movie, obviously, but honestly, I think a lot of this was fairly practical. Like, a lot of the blood's there. The whole, you mentioned it earlier, but when Debbie gets hit with the truck and she just like flies back, so camp. It's so good. Like, that is just so crazy. But yeah, I think a lot of this was also fairly practical because it was 1999. Like, you know, we was like only using computers like so much, baby. Like, it was just so much. So, you know, it's and then of course, shout out to Christopher Hart, the hand from the Addams Family movies, who also plays this hand, who's just had, you know, kind of a whole like little career with doing that. in addition to being a magician, but you know, it's just like, I think I would just say any of those scenes that have makeup and nub in them, I just think are really fun. And then also anytime they use that kind of slapstick gore is just like enjoyable for me as well. Also, I totally forgot to mention, good old Sean Whalen's in this movie from People Under the Stairs. He plays one of the cops. Love that for him too. He gets killed the fuck out. So
yeah, those cops are goofy. Let's be honest. I think that they are really fun and throwaway characters in the best possible way. You know, the second you meet them, you know that they're going to die, but they kill them in such like a ridiculous fashion. I loved his cameo.
Yeah, totally. Do you think there's anything in particular that we already kind of talked about what doesn't work in the movie or anything? Do you have any cons to this film that you're just like, like I watched it, didn't really work for me or anything? Or what do you think could have made the movie better, I guess, like if you were to add anything to it? I know that you like this movie in general, but yeah, like what's something that you think, it just kind of fell flat for me or just wasn't really that great? But maybe also like, is there anything you'd want to do to make it a better film, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that there's much that I would change about this. I mean, we've already talked about sort of the underserved nature of Jessica Alba's character. And if anything, that's probably the biggest sticking point for anybody, you know, the greater audiences who critique the film, who still like the film, that is. Yeah, I mean, if there was anything to explore a little more, I guess we could get a little bit more into Debbie, Vivica Fox's character, like the sect of nuns who are hunting this hand. That could be interesting, but that's maybe even more material for, you know, the Idle Hands prequel or Idle Hands 2 more than this movie.
Totally. I think like, you know, it would have been nice to see a little bit more of who exactly was this character, because she does kind of just come out of the blue and you're just like, oh, okay, I guess we're gonna follow her a little bit. She does deliver my favorite line of, you know, evil's out there and I'm gonna kick its ass. Like, I love that. Like, that's awesome. But yeah, I would agree with that. And I guess also just like, what kind of legacy do you think this movie has had? We've already kind of touched on it as well, but what kind of in regards to cult cinema and cult, you know, status in general, what kind of legacy do you think this movie has had? And, you know, what kind of legacy would you want it to keep having or anything? Like, I just want to see, like, you know, what do you think of kind of the cult status this movie has been able to garner and everything?
I think the legacy for me is it's sort of a nice end cap to that late 90s run of horror movies. But I said recently on social media that there are movies that are parties and there are party movies, and those aren't the same thing. And I think that Idle Hands is a party. Like, it feels like when you're watching it, it's just like at 11 the whole time. And I feel like this is just like a movie that's like good caffeinated energy, despite being a stoner film, that it's just like you could put this on and have it on in the background. And it's just like a good time. And I think that the legacy of having a good like party movie like this, that's always going to be in fashion.
I completely agree. I think that this movie, if anything, this is something, like I said, kind of came to me a little later in my life. But, you know, I think that this movie is kind of a good end cap of those like late 90s movies, like horror films. You know, it is an interesting way of kind of being able to cap that off, because then I don't think we get a ton more of these types of movies coming after. We of course have the Scary Movie franchise. We have the things that, you know, happened in the 2000s for horror, but I think that this is kind of an interesting little, you know, entry within that. And whether you like it or not, I guess is relative, but it's one of those things where I understand this being a movie that people watch during the month of October. This is a nice little 420 kind of movie as well that you can watch, that I actually think is pretty fun, and is relative of the time, or relative of that celebration, if you will. So yeah, I do think that this is a film where I'm glad to have watched it. I would maybe own it. That's a maybe, you know, but it is one of those things where if you did want to own it, there is a Blu-ray Scream Factory edition of it, collector's edition. So that's cute and wonderful. It streams every so often, so you'll probably find it like as normally like in April for 420, and then also like in October you'll probably find it on some streaming service for the free. But yeah, I think this movie has had an interesting little cult status. It's been able to do, you know, it's been able to find its audience, and I appreciate that for what that is. And I also just think like it's cool to see these people who were in the horror genre and have somewhat stayed in there. And I just, yeah, I would love to see if there was like a little prequel or whatever. I get kind of tired of having those things a little bit, but this could be super fun if it was done by the right people. And, you know, it could be really fun, I think, for sure. Do you have any sort of closing thoughts or anything before we start to wrap up on Idle Hands?
No, I love this movie. I think that it is, for me, and I'm always very honest about this, I'm not as obsessed with some of the horror movies of the 90s as some of my peers. That doesn't mean I dislike them. I really like those movies. I appreciate them for what they are. And I get it. I get like the kind of phenomenon around them. But I'm always a little bit at my heart and off the beaten path person. When something like Idle Hands appears in the wild, it means something to me. And I think that this movie works because it is weird and it's unabashedly unusual. It's not afraid to be stupid, which I wish more movies would just embrace stupidity sometimes. That's okay. It's okay to be ridiculous. It's okay to be absurd. And therein, through the absurdity, there's also a good measure of heart. And I like that about it. And it's also just, you know, fun to have a movie that's just like you put it on. It's a bit wild. There's going to be some outrageous blood and a crazy hand and, you know, some good punk music. Roll the credits.
Absolutely. There you go. I mean, I think that this movie is something where you should check it out if you want to. And I think it's a fun watch for those who maybe have not seen it before or who want to see Devin Sawa, you know, be a cute stoner boy. It's right up your alley for that. But thank you so much for coming on the show, Michael. I really do appreciate it. You know, taking time out of your day to talk about this really fabulous film. But please tell our listeners, tell the audience, you know, where they can find you on social media if you want them to find you. And maybe do you have anything upcoming that you want to talk about in terms of projects?
Sure. As far as social media goes, you can find me on Twitter. I don't call it anything else, at Michael Verratti. Also, same name on Instagram. Midnight Mass comes out every other Wednesday, and you can listen to Peaches and I talk about cult cinema from all across Hollywood and not so Hollywood history. Sometime this summer, a feature film that I wrote and directed called There's a Zombie Outside is coming out to film festivals and should be rolling out soon. I'm really excited about that. And yeah, there's always a little bit of mischief happening in my life. So just stay tuned.
I love that for you, for sure. And then, of course, as always, you can find the show. If you want to follow us on social media, you can do so on Instagram at Cult Cinema Circle and then on Twitter at Cult Cinema Circle. Follow me on Letterboxd at Jesse, JesseKremp, all one word, to go see all the stupid little reviews I put on there and see what I've been watching. And go rate, comment, subscribe on YouTube, your podcatcher of choice, whether that's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts at. I'm like on all of them pretty much. And yeah, and then be on the lookout for more fun content coming up. We're doing a lot of anniversaries this year, all right? So you're going to be hearing a little bit about, you know, some spooky, crazy horror movies this, you know, upcoming month, maybe some stupidity as well. You know, you never see, you never know. But as always, thank you so much for taking the time to listen to the Cult Cinema Circle podcast. And remember, there is evil out there, and I'm gonna kick its ass. And take care. Bye.